Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world.
Hello, and welcome to the show, Cybersecurity Where You Are. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO here at the Center for Internet Security, joined as always by the host with the most, the Hall of Famer, Mr. Tony Sager. Tony, how are you, sir?
Great, Sean. Great to be back. Hey, it's a fun time of year and one of our favorite episodes.
So yes. Our Halloween fall episode of the scariest malware. And we're joined by, of anybody listening to the podcast, some true Hall of Famers in terms of CIS, Mr. TJ Sayers and Mr. Randy Rose. How are you both today?
Doing well, Sean. Thanks for having me on.
Wonderful. How are you doing, Randy?
Oh, we're good. I'm good. I'm actually excited. I think this is the first time TJ and I have been on together.
I think you're right, Randy.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
That's true. Well, then we are in for a treat of an episode as we talk about the scariest malware for 2024. So let's kick it off with what we'll call this the low ball. So what makes malware, Randy, scary to you? Stealth, destruction, its evolution, its impact. How would you define scary in terms of malware?
I would definitely lean towards destructive malware being scarier, particularly when we're talking about having a real world physical, or sometimes what we call a cyber physical impact. Right. So when we're talking about any malware that has the ability to impact critical infrastructure systems, water, wastewater systems, electric systems, things like that, we as citizens rely on. I think stealth certainly plays in. It's something that gives a lot of people pause. But, honestly, at this point in history, I think we're so used to the idea that we're being spied on in some way, shape, or form that it's somehow less scary. And I also think, so few actors, even sophisticated state-level actors, have the ability to truly remain stealthy today with the advancements that we have in cybersecurity technology that are like readily available. It's really about, the physical impact. I would say that's certainly the destructive piece is the scariest thing.
Fantastic. TJ, what about you?
Yeah, so I'll take a little bit of a different approach, I guess, to the question. But for me, what makes malware scary is the actor who's behind it, and specifically what their intent is, depending upon the context. So I'll give the example of like a state-sponsored actor, right? They may be using a similar technique or piece of malware, but they may be using that malware to spy or pre-position on the network for the purposes of some type of destructive activity down the line. Whereas a cyber criminal, right, may be using similar tactics, and in some cases, maybe even similar malware, but they're seeking the financial gain element, right? And then where it gets really scary is where you have actor intent kind of blending together, which is something that we have seen happen over the last year or two, where there's a blurring of lines in the intent space and the attribution space, right? So you will see both criminal and state affiliated interests at play in some of the malware and campaigns that play out. So it may look like there's a financial incentive, but in reality, there's some espionage happening behind the scenes, and it's masquerading as criminal activity. And I would say if I had to just pick, stealth or destruction or intent, intent would definitely be it. But I think the stealth element is probably the second most scary element for me, because if you can't detect it, you can't really fix it or protect against it. You have to know it's happening, or at least there's intent to make something happen in order to detect that and defeat it. So stealth is still a huge, huge concern.
Yeah, as Randy said, there's sort of a table stakes part of this, right? I think many of us who grew up in this, we focused on the technology part of the problem, the technical part of the malware and the effects and so forth. But one of the things, as you've said, we've seen really emerge over the years is this mingling of intent, capability, sort of the classic components of network attacks, but also mingling with social effects, the misinformation part of this. And it's both part of what the industry has to grapple with, but also what we at CIS are trying to grapple with. What is our role in this? You know, as you spill into content, once wrote a story about, you know, let's never forget the content is king here, right? Why do people manipulate systems? Well, because they're trying to get to content in the long run, right? The money, whether it's money or social impact or political influence and so forth. So you can't separate it. And I think that's, you know, it's part of where you guys live, right? Is watching this. So Randy, come back to you, you know, sticking with our horror movie theme here, right? We're like the third person observer who's getting to see all this happening at very large scale. And that's one of the neat things that you guys bring to this is not defending just our enterprise, but literally like a couple tens of thousands of enterprises nationwide. So as the observer, sort of looking across all of it, you know, Randy, I'll give you a first shot at sort of what are you seeing that really worries you? Is it a trending thing or about targeting? What is it that you would worry about, that, you know, in this aggregate look that we have?
Yeah, it's a good question. So before I get to it, I'll just say TJ gave like the most intel professional answer on the last one. Anyone, you know, if you didn't pick up on the fact that he's an intel guy by trade, you know, speaking about actor intent is you know, straight out of the intel officer playbook.
Absolutely.
There, so
can't help myself.
No, okay. It was great. So yeah, I mean, getting to that you know, horror movie feeling, you know, I'm not somebody who has like a supernatural beliefs. I don't believe in ghosts and goblins, demons. You know, the things that scare me the most from a human or from a horror movie perspective are the humans, right? Those movies that are like the psychological terrors of, you know, humans doing awful things. And I thinking about it from like a malware perspective, I think the evolution of ransomware that we've observed really over the last, you know, it hasn't been the last year, it's been the last 5 years to, you know, 8 years. You know, we've really seen ransomware grow from a piece of malware into an entire business model. I mean, really, the ransomware as a service model has evolved into this very complex Tammany Hall style mobster outfit with people at all levels of the game. And, you know, I mean, you have people that are developing code and they don't do anything else. There are people who just do initial breach and they don't do anything else. There are people that focus on the network traversal and privilege escalation and data exfiltration and dropping the ransomware. And then you have people that are literally see what they do as customer service. That's they literally view themselves as interacting with a customer, you know, not somebody who's suffering from a ransomware event. And to me, you know, that's a really scary thing, because there are people behind that are doing awful things to other people that are affecting the victims' livelihoods in many cases. I mean, shutting down businesses, shutting down crucial services, all for a paycheck, and they pat themselves on the back. They have zero shame. They've convinced themselves they're doing something good. They even sometimes communicate in a way that appears as if they're doing something good, right? They're offering a service. And that's just wild to me, right? They've convinced themselves that they're not evil. And that's extra scary to me. They don't see themselves as the bad guy.
Yeah, it's sort of removing the undesirables from the environment, maybe. And your point is really, Randy, I'd summarize as, you know, what we're seeing, if you want to, I was often say, if you want to understand capitalism, you study bad guys, not good guys. So there's as you mentioned, there's specialization into different parts, right? There's economies of scale. Why would I write the tools when I could buy them cheaper? Why wouldn't I just rent? And you see this sort of natural ecosystem built up. And, you know, the social machinery that might hold people back, right? Oh, it's against the law. It's culturally unacceptable. Well, that doesn't apply to every culture and every attacker. Right? Every attacker has a risk model also. In fact, in some countries, it's considered a noble pursuit to steal from, say, U.S. Organizations. You know, it's part of their economy, and think nothing of it, right? It's not illegal in the sense that we would think of it within our own culture.
Yeah, it's as if the rules, you know, a different set of rules apply to these actors than apply to the rest of us.
And so back to TJ. So, you know, again, you study this kind of thing for a living, right? Motivation. So it's beyond technical capability. There's also a model of the adversary that you have to understand if you're going to defend yourself. You have to sort of get a sense for what their risk model is and what's acceptable behavior. So what are you seeing then, again, as you look across, you know, tens of thousands of organizations and how they defend themselves against that?
Yeah. So Do you want me to answer the question, Tony, specifically with malware and like go through the like how it has evolved over time, or do you want me to answer the recommendation piece?
Well, let's talk about the malware, because again, you've watched this for years, and so I think that's part of, you know, we have the opportunity to see things at scale that a lot of folks don't get to see. So yeah, if you could take us through that real quickly, I appreciate it.
Yeah. If we're talking about like horror movie vibes, undoubtedly, as Randy noted, it would be the ransomware space. And I think it's helpful to kind of look at how it has evolved in action. Randy talked a lot about the ecosystem that's behind, you know, ransomware, but how it's actually evolved in the space of playing out once it's used, right? So hearkening back to the beginning days, it was sort of became like a known as scareware. I don't think folks remember the old FBI seized your PC type of thing, right? It would lock your PC, lock your system, and then try to extort you for some type of money. You know, next we saw the ransomware space move into this idea of encrypting files and then requesting a ransom to unencrypt your files, right? So first order extortion was pretty much all ransomware was when it was first coming and emerging into the scene. And over the years, we've seen a move over to then double extortion. So they don't just lock or encrypt your system, but they're stealing the information out of the network, exfiltrating that data, then encrypting it. And then the double extortion element is they're threatening to post that data about the organization if they don't get paid the ransom. And then beyond that, we saw triple extortion, where they encrypt the network, they threaten to post the organization's data, and then they will also go after third parties. So individuals that are wrapped up in the organization's data, they'll go after those individuals. They'll also go after partners that organization has worked with, right? And try to extort those partners. So they're getting potentially multiple ransom payments, one from the organization and then one from potentially individuals and partners. And I think the key with the horror movie element and what really has horrified us is the migration into the physical realm. And an example that we'll give is K-12s, so schools, school districts. What we've seen is that triple extortion take place, where they will go in, they'll steal the data, they'll encrypt the network, and then they will threaten to post it. And sometimes they may go after parents. Sometimes they'll even go after the children. And the way that the child element plays out is they will eventually post that data. Or in some cases, the victim pays the ransom, but that ransom group doesn't have quote unquote honor amongst thieves. So they'll still go and try to sell that data 6 months down the road. They'll just kind of obfuscate it with other data sets. And then that data, whether it's posted because the victim didn't pay or they did pay and these ransomware actors decided to sell it anyway, will get bought up potentially by predators. And those predators will then use that information to then target the children. And as you can imagine, the data from a K-12 is extremely sensitive. You got mental and health records in there. You have the child's school schedule, their busing schedule, what their parents' socioeconomic status is, their address, you know, what their school schedule is, who their friends are potentially, right? There's a lot of information in there, unfortunately, that could be used to target them. And that to me is horror. Right, to think that ransomware started off with the scareware, you know, FBI seized your pizza or your PC, all the way to, you know, they're now potentially targeting individual students in K-12 school systems after a ransomware attack.
Yeah, 100%. Because, well, again, you get to the real world consequences. And I think that's where you get the abstract horror movie, as Randy had alluded to, that potentially could never happen. And then you get to the true psychological element of the horror, that these become really permeate that bridge, as it were, between fiction and nonfiction, where it becomes a reality. So that's a really good point, TJ, because I also want to extend on that, TJ. So from 2024, what in your mind is either the most terrifying malware, the most prevalent? Why is it? And that particular strain, whatever, why is that the one that you think is has kind of the lead in 2024?
Yeah, great question, Sean. So in the cyber criminal space, it's definitely ransomware. But if I was to give an example beyond the ransomware space, it would be some of the Chinese aligned campaigns that we've seen. over the last year or so. And when I say Chinese aligned, I'm talking, you know, state-sponsored or affiliated activity. And a couple of examples are in the typhoon threat actor sphere, right? So Volt Typhoon, Salt Typhoon, Flax Typhoon. Volt Typhoon in particular, they are a Chinese state-sponsored group that has been pre-positioning on IT networks for future disruptive or destructive attacks in the event that there's some type of escalated conflict with the U.S. So in military terms, we kind of talk about this in the sense of a first strike capability. So they are positioning to be able to conduct a first strike and degrade things like transportation infrastructure, communications infrastructure, water and wastewater infrastructure, and even energy infrastructure. And what's been really eye-popping about the Volt Typhoon campaign activity in particular is some of the locations that they focused on. So continental United States, generally speaking, and outside the continental United States, so U.S. territories. And one territory in particular is Guam. And Guam is a very strategic location for the U.S. when it comes to larger geopolitical conflicts like the China-Taiwan conflict. And would be a major launching point and hub of activity for any type of U.S. response against China if they did go after Taiwan. So China's ability to get into infrastructure in Taiwan like that gives them that ability to really inhibit and degrade U.S.'s response if we did have to engage in some type of future conflict like that. The other one was Salt Typhoon. So Salt Typhoon is very similar, espionage focused, trying to gain access and pre-position, but it's less of a destructive purpose and more of a spying purpose. So they're in this campaign particularly, they were looking at U.S. telecommunication companies. So when I say telecommunications, you can think like Verizon, AT&T, Comcast, like big providers like that. They were trying to get access to those providers. And specifically, they were after communications of like VIPs, political figures, candidates, court activities, high profile figures that they could try to grab audio conversations and text messages. And there's even been reporting that they were successful in targeting some of the presidential campaigns and targeting some court activities that are of interest to the Chinese Communist Party or the CCP. And the concern here is that this cyber activity, as we alluded to earlier with ransomware, getting into the physical realm, is that this cyber activity is now getting into the information warfare domain, right? So if they have access to conversations and text messages and whatnot, that allows them to operate from an information perspective by leaking content at strategic times, right? To try to discredit someone, discredit a policy, discredit some type of US stance, and also for them to be able to create more believable false narratives. So when it comes to lies, you don't want to just tell a bold lie, right? Because it's you can sometimes decipher, oh, that's so outlandish, it has to be a lie. The better way to do it would be to, you know, drop a one drop of poison in a glass of water per se, right? It's just as deadly, but it's mostly water, 99.9% water. It's just got a little bit of poison in it, but it's enough to kill you. That's what they would do with false narratives, right? Is they could use this pretext of having all this information on comms and communications. So they would take something that's true and then they would spin it and create a false narrative from that truth. And it makes it much harder to detect. And unfortunately, it also makes it more believable. And then quickly, the last one was Flax Typhoon. So similar intent and actor behind it, but mostly focused on like small office, home office, small and medium businesses, and particularly like home routers, firewalls, storage devices, IoT networks, things like that. So if folks are listening and they think, you know, Volt Typhoon and Salt Typhoon, it has nothing to do with me as an individual, there's an entire campaign called Flax Typhoon that's more focused on the individual, unfortunately. So those would be really terrifying when I think of future conflict down the road with a near peer competitor like China.
Yeah. No, I mean, it sets the stage in terms of the, I guess nothing goes untouched with respect to the threat actor's scope in a lot of cases. So, Randy, as we've kind of set out this underlying script, as it were, for this movie, what are you seeing then in the next few years in terms of damage assessment? Is there malware now or strategies, tactics, techniques now that you see evolving over the next few years that would lead to this horror movie vibe?
Yeah, there's two things. The first I want to say, maybe TJ may have created a new horror movie when he earlier he said the FBI stealing his pizza. That is a real horror movie that I would go see.
At its own.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. So certainly everything TJ talked about with the Chinese actors that's associated with Typhoon, specifically Volt Typhoon. And I think it's in particular, it's because of the focus on critical infrastructure for Volt Typhoon. So if we go back to 2017 and we watched, you know, the Russian criminal actors and Russian state-aligned actors pushing what became known as Indestroyer, but, you know, kind of fueled by Pecha, into Ukrainian critical infrastructure space, power generation, being able to push that content in and create a physical impact, a physical effect that actually resulted in, you know, power loss for Ukrainian citizens. I think that's the kind of thing we're looking at, but probably on a grander scale with Volt Typhoon. And it's aligned to ongoing geopolitical tensions, right? Specifically between U.S. and China around Taiwan. So it's likely that China is using Volt Typhoon and the other Typhoon campaigns, and probably other campaigns that we might not yet be tracking, to position themselves for disruptive and potentially destructive cyber attacks that would coincide with an invasion of Taiwan or other, you know, kind of geopolitical objectives that China has. So I think that's, you know, the most it has the most potential to cause damage in the next few years. And then flipping back to the, you know, again, aligned with the horror movie theme, I would say that in the criminal space, we're actually seeing the dead come back alive, right? This year, 2024, we saw both Lockbit and an older botnet that a lot of people are not tracking called 4PX. Both come back from the dead. And Lockbit's actually a really interesting one because, you know, in many cases with ransomware groups, they undergo a government shutdown or, you know, a law enforcement shutdown. They come in, they disrupt operations, they take the entire group down, and then they rebrand and come back as somebody new. Lockbit's like, no, none of that. We're coming back as Lockbit, right? So it's just the same. We're at, like, I don't know, Lockbit 3 or 3.1 or something. Yeah. So I mean, it really is like a horror movie. You know, it's how many Nightmare on Elm Streets can we have? Well, how many Lockbits can we have, right? And Lockbits also scary because they account for something like a third of all ransomware infections in 2024. So, wow. You know, they're pretty scary ransomware group as far as that goes. And then 4PX is the botnet that was with Lockbit's resurrection as Lockbit 3, 4PX was one of the delivery mechanisms. It's basically a botnet that delivers mal spam. That also associated with some other pretty nasty activity outside of just delivering mal spam. But what's cool about 4PX too is when it was discovered earlier this year, it was actually some CIS friends over at the New Jersey Cybersecurity and Communications Integration Cell, what we call the NJKIC, that uncovered 4PX being used in a massive phishing campaign. So shout out to them for discovering that, finding the true zombie bot, right? The bot that came back. Sometimes they come back again. I think that's actually a horror movie. Sometimes they come back again.
No, your point, Randy, I mean, I was just at the Minnesota Cyber Summit, and if you're familiar with the company Scientia, they do great analysis of, you know, detailed analytical work about things like vulnerabilities and CVEs and rate of exploitations and so forth. And, you know, we tend to treat this as episodic, right? You know, you think of sort of pick one episode or one of the versions of Nightmare on Elm Street or one of those. And, you know, we kind of fuel that. There's a cool name with it, right? And here's the thing, and it has a name, and there's proclamations from the government. Oh, and that thing is over, and now we're going on to the next one. Well, a lot of this never ends. And so there's this cascading growth of things to worry about that we don't seem to be able to get a handle on. So you go from, along with our theme here, we go from like episode to, wait a minute, there's a whole zombie apocalypse going on here, this worldwide, that we don't seem to be able to escape from. So when do people get tired of all this, right? You sort of think, I don't know about you, but in our neighborhood, which is getting older at this stage, there's some percent of neighbors, I won't name names, who have opted out. They turn off their lights You know, they make it, we're not home. Let's just pretend we're tired of this whole business here. But we don't get that option in this stuff, do we? So how about some treats from you guys? What is it people could be doing in a more proactive way to deal with these kinds of problems? Because I think one of our dangers is this incident fatigue. You know, here's a thing and it's over, but you know, there's just, it just never ends. And so we have to, you have to start somewhere, right? We got to do something. How about you, Randy, you kick it off. What is before we get overwhelmed by these things, is there any hope here? Any treat to be had in this pile?
Yeah. I mean, as any true horror movie fan knows, there's nothing you can do, you know, it's just, where it's it, we're done. It's, you know, it's, that's, no, no.
Wait a minute. I thought, now one of the tropes of horror movies is, you know, watching the characters make the worst possible decision at a given moment, right? Let's go into that. Let's go into this room that we've never, let's go upstairs. There's a noise. Let's just go on in. What are you people thinking?
Yeah, I mean, I think really, you know, we talk about it a lot, obviously, as CIS, you know, we're the best practices organization, or as you like to say, better practices. I think that's the key, really. It's not about best practices, it's about better practices. We harp on the kind of the same things over and over again, you know, maintaining vigilance and maintaining education, but it really does go a long way in, you know, assisting with preventing a lot of the things that we're talking about. You know, certainly on the cyber criminal side, having, you know, essential controls in place, making sure you're not clicking on every link that comes into your email or opening attachments that pop into your email, those kinds of things are critical to keeping the criminal threat at bay. It's a little bit tougher with things like when we were talking about the Typhoon case or any of these more sophisticated actors that, you know, have it. We didn't even talk about like LumaStealer, for example, which has some capability to bypass MFA, multi-factor authentication. So when you're looking at any kinds of, you know, malware from a future perspective that are looking at taking advantage of or bypassing controls that we're recommending as essential, multi-factor authentication, one-time pads, anything integrated in the zero trust model, that's where we get into this kind of space of, well, what really is the best level of controls that we can have? And I really think it still comes back to what we've been talking about for, I mean, at this point, decades, which is layered defense, you know, really making sure you have multiple layers where you're not solely reliant on multi-factor authentication, but you have, you know, tiers of controls in place. So they might be able to bypass one, but it makes it more difficult when they have six different control sets that they have to get through, right? So I think that's the best thing, especially for small businesses. I know it, from a resource perspective, it's challenging, but there are organizations like ours and other organizations out there that are willing to help. There are a lot of commercial organizations that will provide services at no cost for smaller organizations and nonprofits and things like that. So.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things I think we're grappling with nationally, Randy, that's some great points you made. It feels like, right, there's a set of, I'll call the term that one of our board members, Jane Lute, uses, is what's my social expectation of both security and things I should do about it? In other words, we don't ask individual businesses to solve issues like safety or, you know, commercial transportation. We have to build more defense, you'll call it, into the infrastructure, you know, building codes, you know, inspectors, all these kinds of certifications and so forth. And that's, as a society, that's reasonable for us to expect, but it's not reasonable for us to expect that small businesses can defend themselves against the kind of tradecraft you talked about in the Typhoon series. That's, you know, it's not about being a victim of a crime. It's being, you're part of someone else's national infrastructure of attack. And so that some of these things just have to be managed at a different level than good practice. And so we have to kind of get this blend right, right? What do we expect individuals, businesses to do, and what really we should be managing at a higher level?
And with that, we'll be right back after this quick break.
Operating systems in the cloud are vulnerable to malware, misconfiguration, and more. That is, unless you securely configure them. Enter the CIS Hardened Images. These virtual machine images come pre-hardened to the CIS benchmarks, providing built-in security and compliance you can trust. Available at less than 3 cents per compute hour, CIS Hardened Images save you time and money managing your cloud security posture. Available on all major cloud service platforms. So spin one up today by visiting cisecurity.org.
Thank you. And let's jump back into the episode.
So, DJ, I mean, you've thought about these sort of national strategy things here. What any advice you have for the audience? Okay, so we got to worry about the the door knock or the unexpected phone ring or the moment in the horror movie, but at the same time, there's sort of greater danger happening. And is there something that people need to be aware of or they can do about that?
Yeah. There's one thing that I'll throw out at the national level that I don't think has gotten a lot of coverage as much as at least I think it should, is the cooperation between federal agencies and the commercial sector. So historically, there has been problems there where you have major providers in the commercial sector that all state and local tribal territorial U.S. governments rely upon, private sector businesses rely upon them, but there's not a lot of like cross-pollination and support and coordination with federal folks, especially in the Department of Defense. But the recent NDA, either the last one or the one right before the last one, kind of broke this down where there was actually encouragement and things put in the National Defense Authorization Act that called locations like U.S. Cyber Command to enable the commercial sector to leverage some of the information they're seeing from a defend forward perspective. So it's not just, we're independent, siloed, working on our own things, but now we're working in coordination. And I think that's happening and that's good. And one thing that I try to encourage people with is that all the news we see about Chinese intrusions being uncovered and whatnot, that's a good thing. We're actually discovering these things, right? It's not that it's not been happening previously. It's just that we haven't been catching it previously as much as we are now. We're getting much better at the detection and uncovering and naming and shaming, right? When it's a cyber criminal group by posting wanted posters and sanctions and whatnot, right? And then on the state affiliated side, we're uncovering those intrusions and making it known and making it public, right? That's good news. That's a good news story. But I really think for most organizations and individuals, it honestly is just to get back to the basics or the foundational elements, right? And then just generally stay informed, right? So as an individual, just be careful what you click on. That's still the predominant vector that you're going to get infected with some type of malware, right? Either it's an email or it's something you click on a website, right? Just be highly suspicious. It's okay to be suspicious, right? Just be careful what you click on. Have multi-factor authentication on everything possible. Use a password manager. And password managers are great because you can have passwords that are 15 characters or 100 characters if there's no limit for that website. And you only have to remember one password to get to all your other passwords, right? Have anti-malware software installed. Make sure your firewall's active, right? Big thing, because we've been talking about ransomware. We didn't talk too much about info stealers, but that's another space that's kind of being resurrected from the dead, to harken back to what Randy said, right? Info stealers are huge, right? Spyware, again, is coming back, right? They're just looking to spy on your activities. We thought that was dead and gone, but it's now coming back. So make sure your data is encrypted at rest, right? And make sure your system's up to date. And then the thing I'd throw out for individuals too, because of the criminal space, is freezing your credit files. A lot of people are not aware how easy it is nowadays, right? If you haven't been a victim of identity theft, it's just a matter of when. And freezing your credit is the number one way to prevent from, your identity being stolen. And not just for yourself, but your kids, right? Your family members. If you have even newborn children, the major three credit bureaus, Experian, Equifax, TransUnion, allow you to send information to prove you're the parent of that child, and they will create a credit file and freeze it for that child. Again, identity theft is soaring, and it's actually childhood identity theft is outpacing adult identity theft. So, things like that are really helpful. And, for organizations, the layered defense stuff is critical. Network segmentation, backups, logging,
offline backups specifically.
Yeah, specifically offline backups, because they try to target the backups if they're connected and whatnot. Yeah,
And your point is that it's pretty clear that even the things that are sort of under our control and sort of either built into the technology or rationally priced, we're not taking full advantage of, right? As a community at large. And one of our goals, obviously, at CIS is to help sort through all that. It's so easy to get swept up in the, cool names of Typhoon this and the magic. Oh, my gosh, the nascent state attacker. What am I going to do? The 0 days. We're helpless again. There's actually still plenty that you can do. Not to trivialize the defensive problem. It is a huge problem. But, the things that are under our control, we absolutely need to get a handle on. And again, one of our goals at CIS is to help cut through all this.
Well, I think too, ways. Tony, there's a lot of opportunity for, you know, us at CIS, and we are working on this, but the government and other, you know, key partners also push some of that away from the individual consumer and onto, you know, the software developers and, you know, the community, right? You know, so there's the, you know, secure design or secure by design movement and things like that, that I think, you know, once we get to a place where we are actually building security into the capabilities, I mean, think back, you know, it's probably the 70s or so when cars were made without seatbelts, there was a lot of pushback against putting seatbelts into cars. But today, no car would be made without a seatbelt. It's a basic security
feature. No parent would allow their child to drive without a seatbelt on.
Exactly, right.
So right. And that's a social expectation. Right?
Exactly.
We change it from the technical capability to what do we, in effect, demand and what do we reinforce with insurance and, you know, kind of behavior and social norms and all that. So, yeah, you're right. And I think that, you know, actually, two of the, I'm glad you mentioned that one, Randy, that when I look at what the good folks at CISA have been focused on for the last few years under the leadership of Jen Easterly, you know, my two favorite themes, we've never discussed this one, Sean, but secure by design and this really more from the ONCD side, the regulatory harmonization, right? We have so much oversight now, all well-intended, that creates all this churn and inspection and reporting. And so I won't believe it. We'll save this for another episode, Sean. But those are my two favorite themes out of CISA that I think have enduring quality. We're behind, we're supporting, and I think will take us, are in the right direction. So Sean, I didn't mean to go off on some of my favorite riffs, but back to you. last thoughts here with our amazing and well-informed panelists today?
No, I think we've, Tony, we'll end it with, we've waded through the fog of maw. I've got to mention it, right? I have to throw it in there.
It just cost you $1.
Exactly.
I appreciate my retirement fund. Thanks.
You're welcome. And then we've unhooded the underlying threat actor and we've revealed AI. I have to say it's just part of the contract right now with this. But those are topics that I'd like to come back to with both yourself, Randy, TJ, and think about AI now moving from 2024 into 2025. So this is for the new year, but if you'd be willing to come back, we've got a lot to cover in that space. Because here, ultimately, with what we've reviewed, we've only touched the tip of the iceberg with malware development, the economies in that space as well. So if you want to come back, we'd love to have you and really appreciate you being on the show today.
True pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, sounds good. Happy to come back with TJ anytime.
Fantastic. And also thank you to our audience. Remember to subscribe in all the usual ways. Questions, comments, and concerns send to podcast@cisecurity.org. Remember to check in every Wednesday for episodes like this and much, much more. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today.
The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.